So I called this particular talk "How to Approach Practice," and basically, in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the collected discourses, there are sections that are, I wouldn't call them miscellaneous, but they're like, oh, here's these interesting things the Buddha said about various aspects of practice and living in the world. And somehow they all sort of fit together, but I'm not quite sure exactly how whoever compiled this Nikaya decided all these went together. I'm not sure that if my idea is the correct idea of what the common thread is, but that's okay. Anyhow, so I'm going to start by reading. This is Samyutta Nikaya 5068. And this is the Buddha has a sort of an extended metaphor here. So long as the sun and moon have not risen in the world, just so long there is no manifestation of great light and radiance. But then blinding darkness prevails, a dense mass of darkness. For just so long, day and night are not discerned. The month and fortnight are not discerned. The seasons and the year are not discerned. But bhikkhus, when the sun and moon arise in the world, then there's this manifestation of great light and radiance. Then there is no blinding darkness, no dense mass of darkness, etc. So too, bhikkhus, so long as the Tathagata, the enlightened one, has not arisen in the world, an arhant, a perfectly enlightened one, for just so long there's no manifestation of great light and radiance. But then blinding darkness prevails, a dense mass of darkness. Just so long as there is no explaining, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, disclosing, analyzing, or elucidating of the Four Noble Truths. But, bhikkhus, when the Tathagata arises in the world, an arhant, a perfectly enlightened one, then there is the manifestation of great light and radiance. Then no blinding darkness prevails, no dense mass of darkness. Then there is the explaining, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, disclosing, analyzing, and elucidating of the Four Noble Truths. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand. This is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So here the Buddha is basically saying that when a great being himself arises, but I think he's being very careful not to say me. If you notice, there's no mention of me in this sutta, because according to the teachings, the people like the Buddha arise and have arisen over generations. I mean, going way back. But he says, when they arise, they're like this light that takes away the darkness. This is what the Buddha does. This is what the Buddha is. The Buddha is a light that takes away the darkness. And it's a really great metaphor for what the Buddha is. And the teaching here is basically, boy, don't let this opportunity pass you by. This is like this wonderful opportunity has arisen. A Buddha has arisen. The teachings are available. You've somehow connected to the teachings. Now, go for it. That would be, in colloquial terms, really dig in and take advantage of this incredible opportunity. So that's the first of these teachings. Then there's this one. So this is Samyutta Nikaya 56.11. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the Deer Park. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five thus. So this is the group of five. These are the five guys he hung out with in the forest. So this is very early on in the Buddha's teachings. One of the very first teachings he came across. And these guys he hung out with in the forest were really into real strict, austere practices. Bhikkhus, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual pleasure, in happiness and sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So here the Buddha, right at the very beginning of his life and teaching, is declaring the middle way, this balance between this life of just sort of doing whatever you want and to the seeking pleasure, and this life of mortifying yourself, of trying to sort of punish yourself. I mean, the whole theory these guys had, and there are people like this in India to this day, by the way, this is an old time, this is actually new time as well. The theory was, let's just see how much we can make ourselves suffer. Because if I want to really understand suffering, the more I suffer, the more understanding I'm going to have. That was the theory behind what they were practicing, which of course becomes sort of self-defeating, and which is what the Buddha figured out eventually. This is basically our whole life. This is how we have to lead our life. This is a good advice for our life. So try and stay somewhere between those extremes. You know, don't go all out into the I'm just going to do whatever I want and make myself happy. But don't go into the other extreme, which people who go to this practice sometimes do, of being like really austere and serious and, oh, I can't, you know, I can't do that because that's too much fun and that's not just to have fun. I'm sorry, you know, I'm not allowed to have fun. If this practice doesn't bring joy into your life, you're doing something wrong. Not that it's going to be joyful time, there's going to be cycles when it's like, oh my God, this is like difficult. But the balance has to be there. And this is, you know, the teachings on the middle way, and you see this referred to all the time in different contexts, what the Buddha teaching the middle way. And this is where he spoke about it for the first time. Then you see it described in other ways, in other contexts. But it's the key to the whole thing. So I've got little numbers stuck in my book here to find the right pages for things. So this is from the Samyutta Nikaya 47.19. And this is quite a famous teaching, and it's often called protecting oneself, protecting others. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sumbas. The Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, once in the past, an Akat set up his bamboo pole and addressed his apprentice, Medha, thus, 'Come, dear Medha, climb the bamboo pole and stand on my shoulders.' Having replied, 'Yes, teacher,' the apprentice, Medha, climbed the bamboo pole and stood on the teacher's shoulders. The acrobat then said to the apprentice, 'You to protect me, dear Medha, and I'll protect you. Thus guarded by one another, protected by one another, we'll display skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole.' When this was said, the apprentice Medha replied, 'That's not the way to do it, teacher. You protect yourself, teacher, and I'll protect myself. Thus, each self-guarded and self-protected will display our skills, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole.' That's the method there, the Blessed One said. It's just as the apprentice meditates the teacher. I'll protect myself, bhikkhus. Thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. I will protect others, bhikkhus. Thus should the establishment of mindfulness be practiced. Protecting oneself, bhikkhus, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And how is it, bhikkhus, that protecting oneself, one protects others? By the pursuit, development, and cultivation of the four establishments of mindfulness. It is in such a way that by protecting oneself, one protects others. So this is another theme you see running through the Buddha's teachings. It's like we had make sure that we're taking care of ourselves. That, you know, it's dangerous to think all my job is to take care of everybody else. And that's all. Because if you fall into that idea, then pretty soon you get worn out. You have to take care of yourself first. So that's one level of this. Because once you take care of yourself, once you, as he says, you know, practice the four foundations of mindfulness, once you are mindful and mindfulness is more established, then you naturally protect others because you're living a life of virtue and you're sort of become this beacon for other people. That, and you just naturally, by hanging out with you, they become energized by that energy. It's an interesting way to think about it, but that's, I think, what the practice in one sense is all about. It's like, if I can become more established in mindfulness, if I can become calmer and stiller and more focused, then I'm going to be better around other people. I'm going to be better for other people that I'm around. I'm going to, by protecting myself, I will protect others, because I'm going to be much less likely to speak or act in harmful ways because I'm established in mindfulness. And that means I'm literally protecting other people. It's tricky because, you know, once again, we have to, this is a middle way discussion in a way. If we just focus on taking care of ourselves, if it's just like mindfulness is all about just me, 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 and me reaching enlightenment, then you've lost the heart part of the practice. So it becomes just the mind practice with no heart. But if the heart is there as well, and we express that in our connection to other people, then we have that balance. We're in that middle way. Again, another way to look at a way, I suppose. And so how do we protect ourselves? By mindfully making choices in our daily life, number one. And number two, actually mindfully deepening our practice, putting more energy into our practice. The more we put into the practice, the more that comes back out of it, that we can then share with others. We can protect others more if we practice more. And we also have to, in a sense, this is a little trickier socially, we have to really guard our energy. We have to sort of make sure we don't keep going into, quote, social situations that are unskillful, that we find draining, that we find not useful. We're going there out of habit or out of, you know, because we want to make everybody else feel good. We don't have people think, oh, we're ignoring them. You know, you see this in family situations a lot. It's like families are wonderful things, but there can be times when family stuff or old groups of old friend stuff, which is the same as family thinking this way, where we're just like, oh, I know if I go hang out with people right now, That's going to happen. There's this going to be big rant about politics, or this is going to go on, or blah 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 blah. Don't go there. Make that choice. Protect yourself. Because by protecting yourself, you protect others. Because if you get into those situations, otherwise, sometimes your tendency will be to no, to get into no, you're wrong and I'm right discussions. Just doesn't help anybody and just wears everybody down even more. Okay. So that's that. So this is a lot of these readings have images. The next one is a little questionable, I think, but it's part of the tradition, so I'm going to read it to you. Because suppose that on hearing the most beautiful girl of the land, the most beautiful girl of the land, a great crowd of people would assemble. Now that most beautiful girl of the land would dance exquisitely and sing exquisitely. On hearing the most beautiful girl of the land is dancing, the most beautiful girl of the land is singing, an even larger crowd of people would assemble. Then a man would come along, wishing to live, not wishing to die, wishing for happiness, averse to suffering. Someone would say to him, "Good man, you must carry around this bowl of oil filled to the brim between the crowd and the most beautiful girl of the land." Like walk in front of everybody. A man with a drawn sword will be following right behind you. And wherever you spill even a little of it, right there, they'll chop off your head. So here you are in this really energizing and exciting situation, and you have this bowl of oil on top of your head, and if you spill one drop, that's it. This is an image, right? This is an image. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that man stop it into the bowl of oil and out of negligence turn his attention outwards? Of course, the Bhikkhus all, "No, venerable sir. I made up this simile, Bhikkhus, in order to convey a meaning. This here is the meaning. The bowl of oil filled to the brim, this is a designation for mindfulness directed to the body. Therefore, because you should train yourself thus, you will develop and cultivate mind directed to the body. Make it our vehicle, make it our basis, stabilize it, exercise ourselves in it, and fully perfect it. Thus, because you should train yourself." So this is an image. We're encouraging people to be very mindful of the body, which remember in the four foundations of mindfulness, that's the first one. It's like once we have mindfulness of body, then it's much more likely that we're going to be able to be still and focused and be mindful of other things that are arising at the level of mind. So this image is all about don't forget mindfulness of body. We tend to, it's like if we're not careful, we start to think, "Oh, well, that mindfulness of body, that's for beginners, and I'm paying attention to mind states and looking, and we forget how the foundation of the practice, the first step that we need to really work on is just being mindful of our body. Just that. If we can actually really be mindful, as I say when I introduce the practice sometimes, I say, "Can I just sit and know I'm sitting? Can I really know that? That can I just tune in to the body as a whole?" In the Satipatthana Sutta, in the refrain, there's this phrase that says, "To just to know just know that there is a body." It's not like I need to almost know every little tiny sensation and note everything that's happening, but can I be aware in the broadest sense that if I put that mass of sensation that I'm experiencing at the level of body, if I put that all together, somehow synthesize it, what is all that saying is there is a body. Note that it's not there's my body or I have a body. That all that stuff I'm experiencing, all those physical sensations and all the five physical sense doors, put it all together. It's just, there is a body. Sure enough, there's a body there. And if I can sort of be aware at that level, then I don't get caught up in the minutiae of, oh, my nose itches and my ear does this and my knee does that, which are sometimes skillful things to do, especially if they're not pleasant. But often it's more skillful just to be able to see the body as a whole and sort of see that all of it, when you put it all together, is just, there's a body here. That's it, just the body. But I'm being totally aware of that body the whole time. I'm really being mindful that there is a body. It's a way to think about the practice. Okay, so by the way, if you're taking notes, that was, what was that? That was, it's in 4720. So now we're going to go back to chapter 56. So this is 5634. Bhikkhus, if one's clothes or head were raised, what should be done about it? It's an interesting question. If one's clothes or head were ablaze, what should be done about it? Venerable sir, if one's clothes or head were ablaze, to extinguish one's blazing clothes or head, one arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and comprehension. That sort of makes sense. Yeah, my head and clothes are on there. I'm going to pay total attention to that, to the exclusion of anything else. Of course, the Buddha has a point here. Because one might look on equanimously at one's blazing clothes or head, pay no attention to them, but for so long as one has not made the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths as they really are, in order to make the breakthrough, one should arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. And then he goes, of course, goes to the Four Noble Truths. Isn't this an interesting image? Like, this is how seriously you have to practice. You have to practice as if your head and clothes were on fire all the time. That was like, that's how zealous, I mean, he actually uses the word zeal, to stir up zeal and enthusiasm. What would it be like? How diligent would your practice be if your head and clothes were on fire? Oh, that diligent. I mean, it's an image, but it's like it's encouraging us to be really diligent, to not sort of be lackadaisical in our practice, to really, okay, let's take this really seriously. It's also a metaphor, in a sense, for not wasting any time. Yeah. If my head and clothes are on fire, I don't have a lot of time left, probably. So I better make sure I'm mindful. But it's like, don't waste any time. I studied in the Hindu tradition for a long time, based on someone called Swami Sivananda Rishikesh. And over He lived in this little kutir for many, many years on the banks of the Ganges in the Rishikesh. And this enormous ashram built up all around him, but they kept trying to move him out of this little crumbly kutir, and he wouldn't move. So they had these elaborate pavilions and all this stuff all around where his little kutir was, but he just lived there. And over the door of his kutir, he had a little sign that said, D-I-N, do it now. Great. Maybe you want to put a little sign with D-I-N on your fridge or something, you know, something that it's a good reminder. Do it now. You know, we don't know how long we got. Do it now. This is our opportunity, you know, actually Do this practice. Do it now. Ah. This is right. So this is from much earlier than Samyutta Nikaya. This is Samyutta Nikaya 7.2. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in the bamboo grove. The Brahmin Akasaka, the abusive, heard. It is said that the Brahmin has gone forth from the household life homelessness under the aesthetic Gautama. Angry and displeased, he approached the Blessed One and abused and reviled him with rude, harsh words. So there he is basically cursing out Buddha because another Brahmin had gone and become a disciple of the Buddha. When he had finished speaking, the Buddha said to him, "What do you think, Brahmin? Do your friends and colleagues and kinsmen and relatives as well as guests come to visit you?" It's like, he's just got dissed and this is what he's asking, right? "Sometimes they come to visit, Master Gautama. Do you then offer them some food or a meal or a snack?" "Sometimes I do." "But if they do not accept it from you, then to whom does the food belong?" "If they do not accept it from me, then the food still belongs to me." "So too, Brahman, we who do not abuse anyone, who do not scold anyone, who do not rail against anyone, refuse to accept you the abuse and scolding and tirade you let loose. It still belongs to you, Brahman. It still belongs to you, Brahman." "Brahman, when one abuses his own abuser, who scolds at one who scolds him, who rails against one who rails against him, he is said to partake of the meal. He enters upon an exchange. But we do not partake of your meal. We do not enter upon an exchange. It still belongs to you." This is a great, isn't this a great teaching about how to deal with abusive people? Yeah, because we all deal with this. I mean, it could just be some guy, you know, flipping the bird as we drive by on the freeway. But I mean, you know, there's all kinds of abusive situations we get. It's just this part of life, right? And basically what he's saying is, they're offering you something. When they're abusing you like this, they're offering you something. And you can just say, "Yeah, no thanks, I don't want that." It's like, this is a teaching about being non-reactive, about not just going, doing what they're doing, not reacting in a way that just amplifies the situation. Better to just turn and walk away. I mean, someone's acting in that way, someone's being really abusive to you verbally, especially, there's no way you're going to have a rational discussion with them anyway. There's no way you can sort of calm them down. So just thank you, but no thanks. Just a different way of looking at how to deal with those sort of people than our culture encourages us. Our culture encourages us to fight back, right? But often that just causes more suffering, both for ourselves and for the other person. Just decide not to go there, and to not take that abuse when it's directed at you personally. Okay, moving on. Like I said, this is the Dharma talk of tidbits. So that was that's another. I just came. I mean, I was studying the Samyutta Nikaya and I came across all these different little things that put this all sort of fits together. So this is Samyutta Nikaya 16.12. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahakasapa and the Venerable Sariputta were dwelling at Varanasi. Then in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion and approached the Venerable Mahakasapa. These are two senior disciples of the Buddha. He exchanged greetings, and when they had concluded the greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to him, "How is it, friend Kasapa, Does the Tathagata exist after death? The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata exists after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death? The Blessed Friend has not declared this either. The Tathagata does not exist after death. How then does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death? The Blessed One said, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death? The Blessed One has not declared this either. The Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. So the guy who's asking the questions is now getting kind of frustrated. This is a classical philosophical technique where they take two things and pair them in all the different ways, the negative and the positive, and you get four different possibilities. And usually it's like, well, one of these four has got to be true, right? But in this case, none of them are true. None. Why hasn't the Blessed One declared that? The questioner says, like, he's getting kind of frustrated, right? Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to revulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. Therefore, the Blessed One has not declared this. So this is a theme that you see in, this is a sutta that I like because it's clear. You see this theme on a lot of different places in this, where basically the idea is, you know, there's all these things that people like to discuss, these deep philosophical questions, you know. Does this thing, do you exist after death or not exist after death, or maybe both, or maybe neither? I mean, you know, these sort of philosophical things. And the Buddha basically says, don't bother. Just don't even go there. This is not worth even discussing or thinking about. Instead, pay attention and do the practice. It's trying to figure out this philosophical conundrums just as a waste of time. Don't go there. It's unbeneficial. And it's like, it's so tempting because there's lots of, you know, you can, if you're sort of a philosophy geek, there's lots of different, you know, teachings in both Western and Eastern philosophy that approach these questions from different angles and say this, say that, and just, you get to compare and contrast them all, and you can go down the rabbit hole with this if you want to, but it's just not worthwhile. Don't even bother thinking about these questions. You know, there's other questions that you see, though. You know, does the where did the universe start and when will the universe end? Who cares? Would be the Buddha's answer. Who cares? Doesn't right now, you're alive right now. Now you're practicing. This is what's important right now. Where the universe started or where it's going to end. Might be some scientific interest in that, but don't waste your time. And there's similar topics like that that you see listed in various lists of these sorts of things. Just, it's much more important that what we put our attention to is beneficial. Actually leads towards enlightenment, actually leads towards our mind being calmer and stiller. Trying to figure that one out isn't going to work, isn't going to help at all. Okay. Now I've got a long quote here. I found this on the internet, to be honest with you. I'm not even sure exactly where in the suttas it comes from. But this is the Buddha near death. He's talking to Ananda, and this is another one of those misquotes. I'm now grown old, O Ananda, and full of years. My journey is drawing to its close. I've reached the sum of my days. I am turning 80 years of age. So the Buddha became enlightened in his late 30s, and now he's 80, so he's taught over 40 years. Right? I'm turning 80 years of age. Just as a worn-out cart cannot be made to move along without much difficulty, so the body of the Tathagata can only be kept going with much additional care. So he's not very vain about his body, comparing himself to an old worn-out cart, right? It is only when the Tathagata Ananda, ceasing to attend to any outward thing, becomes plunged into that devout meditation of heart, which is concerned with no bodily object, it is only then that the body of the Tathagata is at ease. So the only time he's not sort of experiencing the difficulties of his body, the pain and aches of his body, is when he's in very deep meditation where he's beyond body experience. And no one can stay there. It's not possible to stay there all the time. He has to keep coming back because he's got a body, right? Therefore, O Ananda, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Rely on yourselves. Do not rely on external help. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp. Seek salvation alone in the truth. Look not for assistance to anyone besides yourselves. So this is like pretty much the last teaching of the Buddha. That's why it's so famous and quoted so often. Where he's basically saying, because all of his disciples knew he was going to die soon, and they were all freaking out. Like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We don't have the Buddha to teach us anymore. You know? And he's saying, you got to take care of yourself. Don't expect something to magically happen that you're going to, you know, do anything other than rely on yourself. Be a lamp. The light, a lamp, the light. If you want to be enlightened, you have to be a lamp unto yourself. And this is true. Basically, you know, the teachings of the Buddha over and over say, you got to do this yourself. No one can magically do it for you. You got to do this yourself. This is a constant recurring theme in the Buddha's teachings. It's all up to you. I mean, you know, there's teaching that basically says, if you really want to understand that, you have to figure it out for yourself, and then you'll know it's true. But don't depend on anything written or any scriptures or anything like that. Know the truth through your practice. Be a lamp unto yourself. You know, become your own light. But at the same time, the Buddha said that, he also says, this is Samyutta Nikaya 45:2. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. And the Buddha answers, Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When the bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. So this seems to be saying exactly the opposite of the other thing I just read. Well, we have to be a light unto ourselves. And you have to do it all yourself. But at the same time, he's saying that the whole of the holy life, not half, Anbandha says it's half, and the Buddha says, no, it's the whole thing, is about Sangha. It's like having people around you who are also practicing and being in connection with those people and having that heartfelt connection. It's they're doing their thing themselves, you're doing your thing yourself, but you encourage each other. Yeah. There's that energy of Sangha, that the energy of group practice, of being together with others, living with others, practicing with others, going on retreat with others, whatever, however you want to look at it, that is so powerful. That is what holds this practice together. I mean, the Buddha became enlightened all by himself. He just went off and practiced. If you read the stories, after many, many hundreds of lifetimes of just before then, this particular lifetime he became enlightened. Right? But the Buddha kept talking about this over and over and over again, how important Sangha is, how important staying connected with others who practice. It encourages you to keep practicing. It gives you people who you can share with, who will understand what it is you're saying, who will understand the struggles you're going through, who will understand that, yeah, this isn't always easy, this practice, that it's somehow we have to work at it, and it's a struggle sometimes. But when you're in Sangha, then you can talk to someone and they'll say, oh yeah, I've been through that. I'm going through that right now, as a matter of fact. Or they encourage you. And just the other thing is just practicing together. Even in this somewhat weird electronic way that we practice together these days, some of the time anyway, it encourages us. We show up and, oh look, there's those other people I know who always show up for these talks and always come, join the Sangha. And it's like, on some level, you get connected to these people. You sort of recognize them and you go, oh yeah, there's that Jhana, she's here again, or whatever it is. We just sort of make that connection. And we sort of, it encourages us. It encourages you to keep practicing because these other people are practicing. That's the power of Sangha. And it's also an incredible gift you can give others. It's an interesting way to think about this, but think about this. If you come and practice with others, then you're encouraging them to practice. This is a gift you're giving them just by showing. It's good to think about this. It also means you think, oh, I gotta keep giving that gift. This is the gift that keeps on giving. That's an ad from something or other, I forget. But that's what it is. This is like, it's a real gift to give to others to come and practice with them. Because it encourages them to practice with you and keep practicing. Because they see you're doing that. Okay. Of course, I have a poetry about this as well. I'm sure some of you have heard me read this probably more than once, but this is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. And it's a poem called Sangha, which I think sort of sums up what I was trying to say. It's called Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries and let us not lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fire in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to force our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take oneself is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. That's what Sangha is. So